There are many podcasts and academic papers that refer to the many myths of the Christmas truce in 1914. But it did happen, and it happened for several days before, during and after that first Christmas on the Western Front. Men from both sides who were supposed to be killing each other put down their guns and they peered at each other across the sandbags and the parapets of the frozen ground of No Man's Land. And then they cautiously climbed out of their trenches and approached each other. But what happened next? Well, in this podcast, we're going to find out. I'm not going to discuss the well-documented myths because other podcasts and other programmes have done that in great detail. Surely everyone knows there was no organised football match and no controversial winning goal by either side. There's so much oral and documentary evidence to prove that the truce really did take place. So today in this podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, we're going to discover what took place through the eyes of the soldiers who were there rather than the history books. So let's just set the scene, shall we, with an example of the sort of stories that we're going to hear tonight, mainly from published accounts, but I've managed to find some primary accounts from newspapers here in Northampton. But the first words I want you to listen to is from a man who became, after the war, a famous writer, Henry Williamson. And this is what he said about what happened on Christmas Eve.
On Christmas Eve, we had a job to do in No Man's Land, which put the wind up everybody. That is to say, we were all quiet among ourselves. The job was to knock in these posts 18 inches into this frozen soil, and we'd be 50 yards away from the Germans, and if we crept out, trying to avoid our boots ringing on the frozen ground, and expecting any moment to fall flat with the machine guns opening up, and nothing happened. And within 2 hours, we were walking about and laughing and talking, and there was nothing from the German lines. And then about 11 o'clock, I saw a Christmas tree going up on the German trenches, and there was a light. And we stood still, and we watched this, and we talked. And then a German voice began to sing a song, Heilige Nacht. And after that, somebody, come over, Tommy, come over. And they still thought it was a trap. But some of us went over at once, and they came to this barbed wire fence between us, which was five strands of wire, hung with empty bully beef tins, to make a rattle if they came. And very soon we were exchanging gifts. The Germans started burying their dead, which were frozen out, and we picked up ours and buried them. And little crosses of ration box wood were nailed together, quite small ones, and indelible pencil, they would put, the Germans, for Vaterland und Freiheit, for Fatherland and Freedom. And I said to a German, excuse me, but how can you be fighting for freedom? You started the war, and we are fighting for freedom. And he said, excuse me, English comrade, camarade, but we are fighting for freedom, for our country. And I say you also put, here rest in God, an unbecanter, held. Here rest in God, an unknown hero, in God. Oh yes, God is on our side. But I said he's on our side. And that was a tremendous shock. I began to think that these chaps, who were like ourselves, whom we liked, and who felt about the wars we did, and who said, it'll be over soon because we will win the war. And we said, no. Well, English comrade, do not let us quarrel on Christmas Day.
I've heard that interview many times over the years, but it still gets to me, that last passage, really, when they meet up with the Germans and they realise that the Germans are not the ogres, they're not the beasts drinking blood of children that the British propaganda had made them out to be. No, they were young lads from cities and towns in Germany that were just like the cities and towns in the United Kingdom that our lads had come from. They were fighting what was effectively, I suppose, our cousins. People with the same morals, values, the same beliefs in God, the same hope for a bright future, for freedom. He talks about freedom there. It's nothing like the modern soldiers have been fighting in recent wars in Afghanistan when they were fighting the Taliban, or fighting terrorists like ISIS or Hamas at the moment, who are fundamentally different in their beliefs. It's nothing like that at all, or it was nothing like that at all. And it must have come as quite a shock, and it must have been quite difficult then to pick up arms a few days later and go back to the duty, to the job that they were there for, which was to kill each other. And that's something, it's a theme as we look at the accounts of the soldiers in this podcast from both sides of the wire, it's a theme that will crop up more than once. An example of this surprise that the soldiers encountered was given in an account, a letter written to his mother by an officer in the 2nd Queen's Battalion. And his name was Lieutenant Geoffrey Hennecke. And he wrote back to his mother, as I said, and he said, "The next morning, a most extraordinary thing happened. I should think quite of the most, one of the most curious things in the war. Some Germans came out and held their hands up and began to take in some of our wounded. And so we ourselves immediately got out of the trenches and began bringing in our wounded also. The Germans then beckoned to us, and a lot of us went over and talked to them, and they helped us bury our dead. This lasted the whole morning, and I talked to several of them, and I must say they seemed extraordinary fine men. It seemed too ironical for words. There, the night before, we'd been having a terrific battle, and the morning after, there we were smoking their cigarettes, and they smoking ours." Now, initially, the British High Command, and probably the Germans as well, they weren't so much concerned about their armies laying down their guns at Christmas to fraternise with the Germans. They were more worried about surprise German attacks. On Christmas Eve, GHQ issued a signal that was to be passed to all units in the front line, and it read, "It is thought possible that the enemy may be contemplating an attack during Christmas or New Year. Special vigilance will be maintained during this period." Now, because it took a while for messages to get from GHQ to the front line, it was well after dark before this message reached the battalions that were in the front line. And in many sectors, it was too late because the Christmas truce was well underway. And the men like Henry were already in no man's land exchanging cigars, photographs, and doing probably the most important task of all that both sides did on that night and in the following few days. They buried their dead from the fighting over the last few days. Now, after all of the fighting in recent days, when there were heavy casualties, there was bound to be suspicion on both sides. And there was a Scotsman serving with the, as an officer with the Cameronians, Malcolm Kennedy, and he said, "German troops opposite were clambering out into the open, waving their arms in the air and making friendly gestures in our direction. As they were unarmed and showed no signs of hostile intention, I was wondering what to do when a message came along from the company commander. He said, 'Don't shoot, but count them.' He warned me against letting any Germans come too close, as it might only be a ruse on their part to enable them to inspect our positions at close quarters." Now, not only had the soldiers from both sides been killing each other in the few days before Christmas, they'd also had to deal with the problems of the weather. It had rained constantly on and off. Trenches, as we know, were flooded in this part of the battlefield in late 1914. But then on Christmas Eve, it got colder, it stopped raining, and a frost appeared, and it froze the ground. And the situation was described by a man called Albert Moren, who was also serving with the 2nd Queen's. And he said, "It was a beautiful moonlit night, frost on the ground, white almost everywhere. About 7 or 8 in the evening, there was a lot of commotion in the German trenches. And there were these lights, I don't know what they were, and they sang Silent Night. I shall never forget it. It was one of the highlights of my life. I thought to myself, what a beautiful tune." As I read that, I thought about that man Albert and these other men whose accounts we're reading, and it must have been quite a surreal experience. They'd been trying to make themselves feel as Christmassy as possible, whilst at the same time being wary of the enemy opposite, thinking of their loved ones back home, and also looking out into no man's land and seeing the bodies and, in some cases, the wounded of their comrades that had fallen in the last few days. So I suppose when there is unexpected humanity and goodwill coming from an unexpected quarter, you'd be quite keen, wouldn't you, to entertain it, to get involved with that. You'd cling on to anything, wouldn't you, to remind you of home. And what better way of doing that would be to meet up and shake hands with comrades, although they're in different uniforms, and to exchange those photographs. And what a lot of them did when we look at these accounts is that they looked at the photographs of their loved ones. They told stories of their families and children and what they were up to. And again, as we said earlier, they realised that their families at home were the same, whichever side of the water they came from. And burying the dead, yes, that would have been an awful task for anyone at any stage in the war. But in amongst all that goodwill, in amongst drinking perhaps brandy or schnapps, it was crucial to bury their dead for all sorts of reasons. There was a 19-year-old officer called 2nd Lieutenant Arthur Pelham Byrne. He was serving with the 6th Battalion of the Gordon Highlanders. And he was intending to train for the Anglican ministry. And he wrote a letter to a school friend back at home. And he said that burying the dead was awful, too awful to describe, so I won't attempt it. But he said that they held a service. And he said it was the most wonderful joint burial service. Our padre arranged the prayers and an interpreter wrote them out in German. They were read first in English by our padre and then in German by a boy who was studying for the ministry. It was an extraordinary and most wonderful sight. The Germans formed up on one side, the English on the other. The officers standing in front, every head bared. Yes, I think it was a sight one will never forget. The other surprise that comes up in so many of these accounts is when the British soldiers talked to their German counterparts, and they were surprised to find that so many of those Germans spoke perfect English. A lot of the officers had attended British universities, and a lot of the NCOs and other ranks had worked in the hotels in London, in hairdressers, barbershops and things like that. There was a private field. He was serving with the Buffs, the East Kent Regiment, and he said he was approached by a small, grubby and ill-shaven German who spoke a few words of English. I asked him if he ever been to England, and he said, "No, but I'm a clerk. I do business with England." "What's your business?" I asked, and he shrieked with joy as he gravely said, "I export mouth organs." An officer in the Queen's Westminster Rifles, he wrote home and said to his family, "One German NCO I spoke to said he went to America 2 months every year on business and learnt his English there. He was to have been married on the 12th of October to a lady in Chicago. I told him we would have them licked by Easter and he could get married then, and he laughed." Now, whenever men, or particularly soldiers, get together, they take the mickey out of each other, don't they? It's what they do. We call it banter. A Lieutenant Hulse, he found himself in an animated exchange early on Christmas Day in no man's land. He was serving with the Scots Guards. He said that the Germans explained that they had only come out to wish us Happy Christmas, and they trusted us implicitly to keep the truce. And the German he was talking to said he came from Suffolk, where he'd left a girlfriend and a motorbike behind. He said he told me that he could not get a letter to the girl and wanted to send one through me. I made him write out a postcard in front of me in English, and I sent it off that night. But I told him she probably would not be a bit keen to see him again. I wonder how he reacted to that. And I wonder whether he ever did get to meet that girl and pick up his motorbike, or whether either of those men survived the war. And keeping with this theme about Germans who had English connections, Private Hunter of the 2nd Battalion, the Monmouthshires, he described a German that he met as a nice chap who could speak English, and he talked to him for 2 hours. He said, "He told me he wished it was all over, he'd had enough of it. He was a medical student who'd been to England for 2 years and in France, and was coming to England last August, only for the war. He asked me what we were at war for, and I told him he'd better ask Wilhelm. He told me he had many friends in England and France as he'd had in Germany, and asked why should he be fighting his friends and his friends fighting him. He would much rather be having a game of football than this. He was only 20 years of age, but there was a lot of old men with them, and they were asking him so many questions to ask me. The first man I came to was an old man, and when we shook hands, I thought he was not going to let my hand go. The tears came rolling down his cheeks, and I felt so sorry for him as he was so old and he wanted to go home. And as I'm reading that, I'm thinking, blimey, this is only, what, 4 months into the Great War? Little did they know that it wasn't going to be over soon. There was going to be, what, another 4 Christmases before these men would go home, if indeed they did go home. Even more surprise would have been a man from the Cheshire Regiment called Graham Williams. He could actually speak German. Not many could speak German on the British side. And many men asked him to translate what they wanted to say with their German counterparts. Whilst he was doing this, he was suddenly accosted in no man's land by a man with a Cockney accent. He says, as I was talking, a chap came up to me and he actually greeted me with the words, "What's your cock? How's London?" I said, "Good Lord, you speak like a Londoner." And he said, "Well, I am a Londoner." I said, "Well, what on earth are you doing in the German army?" And he said, "Well, I'm a German, but I'm a German Londoner." And apparently he'd been born in Germany, but had gone to England almost immediately afterwards with his parents, who had a small business in the East End of London. And he'd been brought up in England and gone to school in England. But as by German law, he was still a German national. He'd been called up to go to Germany to do his national service, which was 3 years at that time. And afterwards, he came back to London, joined his parents and got a job as a porter at Victoria Station. He told me all this. He spoke absolute Cockney and it was most extraordinary. So rather than me talking all the way through this, let's hear a couple more first-hand accounts from the soldiers themselves, from both sides of the wire that were there on that Christmas 1914.
On Christmas Eve, at noon, fire ceased completely on both fronts. Of course, it was unusual that the opposite side also ceased fire. Then my officer controlling the sentries came in and said, may I ask a question there? Do you expect a surprise attack? Because it's very unusual, the situation. I said, no, I don't think so. But anyhow, everybody is awake, nobody sleeping and so on, and the sentries are still on duty. So I think it's all right.
We were in the front line. We were about 300 yards from the Germans, and we had, I think, on Christmas Eve, we'd been singing carols and this, that and the other, and the Germans had been doing the same, and we'd been shouting to each other, sometimes rude remarks, more often just joking remarks. Anyway, eventually a German said, "Tomorrow you no shoot, we no shoot." And the morning came and we didn't shoot and they didn't shoot. So then we began to pop our heads over the side and jump down quickly in case they shot, but they didn't shoot. And then we saw a German standing up waving his arms and we didn't shoot and so on. And so it gradually grew.
Now, on the most part, the accounts I've read and listened to, the soldiers returned to their trenches with good feelings about their comrades and enemies on the other side of the wire. But as we've mentioned a few times, the main task that both sides carried out in no man's land was burying the dead. There was a Lieutenant W.B.P. Spencer, and he was serving with the 2nd Battalion of the Wiltshire Regiment, and he wrote down his feelings in a letter to his mum a few days after the truce. He talks about, as the others have done, how they slowly but surely trusted each other, made their way across the parapets, and then they discovered their dead of both sides from the fighting in the few days before Christmas. And in his sector, they agreed that the armistice would last for 4 hours and that each side should carry the dead men back halfway for burial. There'd been many losses in the fighting just before Christmas. He says that both sides came out, met in the middle, shook hands, wished each other the compliments of the season and had a chat. And then they carried over the dead. And like an account I read earlier, he didn't want to describe the condition that the dead were in. He says, "I won't describe the sights which I saw, but which I will never forget. We buried the dead as they were, then back to the trenches we went with a feeling of hatred growing stronger after what we'd seen. It was strange after just shaking hands and chatting with them. It was a very weird Christmas day. There was little firing during the 2 days. Now, we don't know what condition the dead were in. We don't know what fueled those feelings of hatred, because he hasn't told us. How could he tell us? How could he describe what he'd seen there in no man's land? What had happened to his mates? We'll never know. What we do know is that he went back to his trenches with no good feelings about the men that he'd just been socialising with in no man's land. Now, these accounts that I've been reading to you have been sourced from mainly two books. One is called The Christmas Truce, The Western Front, December 1914, and was written by Malcolm Brown and Shirley Seaton. And I bought that in a charity shop some years ago, and inside the cover it tells me that I paid 50 pence for that. And another book that I've been using to a lesser extent is called 1914 Voices from the Battlefields, written by Matthew Richardson and published by Pen and Sword. But for these next few accounts, I'm going to look at some primary evidence, some correspondence that was published in the Northampton local newspaper, the Northampton Mercury. And then when we've done that, we're going to tackle that elephant in the room. We're going to look at what actually happened when it came to football during the Christmas Truce. And I'm going to talk about another coincidence that occurred to me when I stood on the battlefield where that truce took place a few years ago. And I was reading the account of one of the men from the Cheshire Regiment that had taken part in the truce. And what happened then, as I read that account, will live with me forever. But that's coming along a little bit later in the podcast. So the first account I found in the local paper was written by a private J.W. Moulton. And he was serving with the 6th Cyclist Platoon in the 8th Division. And he wrote a letter to his parents who lived in Urchester in Northamptonshire. And this is what he said to them. He said, "I hope you had a Merry Christmas at home. We did not have a very enjoyable time here. We had bully beef and biscuits for Christmas dinner, and we did not relish that. After dinner, our officer took us up to the trenches to have a look round. There wasn't any firing going on, and we were quite safe. Both sides came to an agreement to cease fire for Christmas Day. The Germans kept Christmas the same as us. Our chaps went over to the German lines and exchanged cigarettes and eatables with them. They've been told by their officers that they're winning all along the line, and they will have a shock when they know the truth. Some of them can speak English as well as us. One chap said he'd been living in England for the last 7 years and would like to get back there again. Our chaps got a lot of buttons and cap badges off them for souvenirs. It's hard to believe that they're firing to kill one day and then going up to one another and having a talk." He then pleads with his parents to send him some more stuff that he needs for the winter. He said, "I don't know if there's anything you can send me. We've more kit now than we know what to do with. We keep getting things from various funds, and it would surprise you to see all the stuff that keeps coming up. We've just had Princess Mary's gift. It's a very nice present. And I'll show and try and post it home to you." Now, just getting away from the actual truce itself, whilst I was going through these newspapers, I found an account from a pioneer called John Spencer, who came from Rushton in Northamptonshire. And he'd been sent home suffering from frostbite that he'd picked up in the trenches around Ypres. And he said, "At one time, the German trenches were only 80 yards from ours. At night, the Prussian guards tried to break through our lines. They are fine, big fellows, similar to our guards, but their imposing size went for nothing, for as soon as a row of them got up to charge us, our machine guns mowed them down like skittles. German prisoners have told us that their officers drive them forward at the point of a sword or a pistol. I've had a narrow escape once. I was lining the trenches, letting fly at the Germans, when the light shell burst right above my head. A splinter passed through the right sleeve of my overcoat and cut and burnt the sleeve of my tunic at the elbow. But luckily, it didn't touch my flesh. When I got my frostbite, I'd been 3 days in the trenches, during which time it snowed, then rained, and then finally froze. I felt my feet getting numbed. When I got up to leave the trenches, I could only hobble. It took me 4 hours to walk 2 miles. At that time, there was not a great deal of pain. When I took off my boots, my feet swelled to twice their normal size. And when the blood started to circulate again, my feet felt as they were being put through the rollers of a mangle. In this next account, we have some evidence of how the Germans respected England, and in particular, our national anthem. This account was written by a Private W. Pentelow. He was serving with the 1st Rifle Brigade, and he was writing to his sister who lived in Wellingborough. He said, "We had it quiet on Christmas Day, as we didn't do any firing. Plenty of singing in the trenches on Christmas Eve, both carols and songs. Sometimes the Germans chimed in and also cheered. They had a few instruments and gave us several tunes. Home Sweet Home was one which was very good, and anyone who had a home must have thought of it. They also played our national anthem and afterwards gave 3 cheers. And they also shouted, 'Come over, you English people. We will meet you halfway.' And several other jokes were passed. Well, on Christmas Day, we were out of our trenches and we met halfway and shook hands and exchanged smokes. I had 7 cigars and 7 cigarettes from them. I also gave a few of them my home address. They are about fed up and will be glad when it's over, the same as we shall. But those times are over now. We are shooting one another as before. Some of them seem very nice chaps, but some were very old, and others were quite just boys." Now, the truce wasn't carried out all along the front at this stage. It wasn't organised, and it was a local truce, I suppose. And I've got evidence here that I found in our local newspaper of a German lieutenant who sent this message over to the British lines. And this is what he said to his British counterparts. He said, "Gentlemen, you asked us yesterday to temporarily suspend hostilities and to become friends during Christmas. Such a proposal in the past would have been accepted with pleasure. But at the present time, when we have clearly recognised England's real character, we refuse to make any such agreement. Although we do not doubt that you are men of honour, yet every feeling of ours revolts us against any intercourse with the subjects of a nation which for years has, in an underhand way, sought the friendship of all other nations. They might help annihilate us. A nation also which, while professing Christianity, is not ashamed to use dum-dum bullets, and whose greatest desire would be to see the political disappearance and social eclipse of Germany. Gentlemen, you are not, it is true, responsible leaders of English politics, but all the same time you are Englishmen whose annihilation we consider to be our sacred duty. We therefore request you to take such action which prevent your mercenaries, whom you call soldiers, from approaching our trenches in future." That message really does give us an insight into what those German Imperial soldiers thought of the British, not just the British soldiers, but our politicians, and what they thought that the BEF and our allies were trying to do to Germany. They didn't see it, that we were trying to defend France and Belgium from German annihilation. They thought it was the other way round. As always in life, there are 2 sides to every story, aren't there? Right then, let's look at this story of football being played during the Christmas truce. Now, football was very popular at this stage, it is today, amongst both the British and the Germans. And we know, of course, that football was played behind the lines. It was a way that the men could relax when out of the lines. But when it comes to an organised football match being played in no man's land, as depicted in adverts and all sorts of other stuff, there's no evidence anywhere, I don't believe, that this organised football match was played. I've seen accounts that the Germans had won 3-2, but there's no actual written evidence either in battalion diaries or in the accounts written or recorded by the veterans after the war. But there are plenty of examples of football being mentioned. There was a German soldier called Hugo Klemm, and he wrote, "Everywhere you looked, the occupants from the trenches stood around talking to each other and even playing football." Another German, Lieutenant Johannes Neumann, he said, "Suddenly a Tommy came with a football, kicking already and making fun, and then began a football match. We marked the goals with our caps. Teams were quickly established for a match on the frozen mud, and the Fritzes beat the Tommies 3-2. So perhaps it's just from that account that the myth of the organised football match came from. But on the other hand, a Private Alexander Runcie, serving with the 6th Gordon Highlanders, he said, Some chroniclers of the true incident have claimed that a football match was played in no man's land. This was not the case, as the shell holes, ditches, barbed wire and churned up condition of this part of the ground rendered it impossible to do so. Another soldier from the Queen's Westminster Rifles, he said, "On Christmas Day we had a football out in front of the trenches and asked the Germans to send a team over to play, but either they considered the ground too hard, as it had been freezing all night and was a ploughed field, or their officers put the bar up." So that match didn't take place, did it? Now we can actually listen to one of those men that was there. Ernie Williams was serving with the 6th Battalion of the Cheshire Regiment. And Ernie talked about what happened on Christmas Day.
We was in the line at just left of Ypres. It was quiet, and then suddenly, across no man's land, which is quite a stretch to be about a couple hundred yards between the two lines, there was a sound of singing, you see. And we thought they were carols, but it was Germans, you see. So, naturally, we followed suit. We started the old singing lark and passed the night away like that. And then when early morning came, it was rather misty. And looking over the top of the trench, you could see in no man's land four figures, four or five, little group. And then from right and left, there was a swarm out of the line to join with. We in our part of the line, we all jumped out of our trenches and joined them. So we got a great big mass of soldiery. The people in front of us were Bavarians. Some of them had great big beards. I was only 19. I was scared to death. And, of course, naturally at Christmas, we'd had parcels from home, which... And then the Queen of the time sent us a little box with cigarettes in, a rather golden little case. I've got that damn thing somewhere, but don't know where it is. And we shared fags, goodies, with the Germans. And then from somewhere, somehow, this football appeared. But we didn't form a team. It wasn't a team game in any sense of the word. It was like how I learned my football in Hillgate Streets, being chased by a policeman. You know, it was a kickabout. Everybody was having a go. You know, one fella was in goals and, you know, they were shooting and passing. And actually, I was a bit scared, I'll admit that. I was really scared. Because in my bringings up, you see, it was Sunday school and one thing or another, and I'd always been taught that if you didn't smoke, you see, if you smoked before you was 21, you'd stunt your growth, they used to tell the children then. So I had made up my mind I wasn't going to smoke till I was 21. And I kept those cigarettes all for quite a time. I never smoked them because I was a bit innocent, like, I thought.
Williams also gave a TV interview in 1983. He said in the interview, "I should think there was about a couple of hundred taking part. I had a go at the ball. I was pretty good then at 19. Everyone seemed to be enjoying themselves. There was no sort of ill will between us. There was no referee, no score, no tally at all. It was simply a melee, nothing like the soccer you see on television." Now, I mentioned earlier that I encountered another coincidence on the battlefield, one of many. And this coincidence took place on a very hot summer's day in 2017, when I was guiding a family of nine people that had come from Cheshire, and we were heading down to the Somme, following in the footsteps of one of their relatives that had died in 1916. And he was serving with the 6th Battalion of the Cheshire Regiment, and it was that regiment that Ernie Williams was serving with. So from the evidence that I'd got about their relative, it was clear that he was also serving with the Cheshires during the Christmas of 1914. So I took them to the border between France and Belgium, to Wolfingham, and this is where they were in that cold winter of 1914. And this is where their relative would have experienced the truth that we've been talking about in this podcast. And I read a letter from a man that was also serving with the 6th Battalion, a man called Frank Naden. And I'll just read a part of his letter now to you, as I did so as we stood there in the middle of that field. Naden said, "On Christmas Day, one of the Germans came out of the trenches and held his hands up. Our fellows immediately got out of their trenches and the Germans got out of theirs, and we met in the middle. And for the rest of the day, we fraternised, exchanging food, cigarettes and souvenirs. The Germans gave us some of their sausages and we gave them some of our stuff. The Scotsmen started the bagpipes and we had a rare old jollification, which included football, in which the Germans took part. The Germans expressed themselves as being tired of the war and wished it was over. They greatly admired our equipment and wanted to exchange jackknives and other articles. We had a gruesome task in burying a Frenchman whose body had been lying for a couple of weeks in front of our trenches, and the Germans helped us to dispose of him. Next day, we got an order that all communication and friendly intercourse with the enemy must cease, and we did not fire all day, and the Germans did not fire at us. Sergeant Major Naden thinks the war will last some time." He was right about that, wasn't he? "And we shall require a great number of men to finish it." He was right about that as well. "All the men at the front are looking forward to the time when the new armies will be in the field and when a real advance can be made. And they are also anxious that no men at home who can possibly join them should shirk his duty." Now, when I finish reading that account, two of the ladies that were with me put their hands up and they said that the man whose account I'd just read was their school teacher in the 1950s in Cheshire. It was him, the same man. What are the chances of that, that we should stand there in this field? And I would quote the words of Sergeant Major Naden. And they went on to explain that he was always good to the family that I was guiding. And it now clicked, because he would have been the commanding officer of their relative that died on the Somme in the next year. Naden survived the war, obviously, because he gave this account, and he would have been there when their relative died. As I said earlier, it was one of those moments in guiding on the Western Front that I won't forget ever, and I'm sure that family won't forget either. So today, we're used to the press sensationalising anything that happens in the world, and it was no different in 1914. And in the next few minutes, I want to look at some of the ways in which the newspapers of the time reported and commented on the truce. It gives you an insight into the way that people thought at the time that were at home, that weren't on the Western Front. The South Wales Echo on the 1st of January, just a week later, in their additional said, "When the history of the war is written, one of the episodes which chronicles will seize upon as one of the most surprising features will undoubtedly be the manner in which the foes celebrated Christmas. How they fraternised in each other's trenches, played football, rode races, held sing-songs, and scrupulously adhered to their unofficial truce will certainly go down as one of the greatest surprises of a surprising war." A writer in the Daily Mirror really got inside the British and German soldiers' heads on the 2nd of January when they wrote, "The soldier's heart has rarely any hatred in it. He goes out to fight because that is his job. What came before, the causes of the war and the whys and wherefore bother him little. He fights for his country against his country enemies. Collectively, they are to be condemned and blown to pieces. Individually, he knows they're not bad sorts." In the Times on the 4th of January 1915, they quoted one of the British soldiers that had taken part in the truce, and he said, "We cherish no anger against the masses of our enemies. We pity them for the ease with which they have suffered themselves to be blinded and misled. But as the wonderful scenes in the trenches showed, there's no malice on our side, and none in many of those who have been marshalled against us." But over in Germany, the press had a different view of things. A Berlin newspaper printed a long article pointing out the dangers of fraternisation, and it ended by saying that war is no sport, and we are sorry to say that those who made these overtures or took part in them did not clearly understand the gravity of their situation. Well, I don't know who wrote that report, but how can they say that? How can they possibly say that? How can they get inside the minds of the men and comment in such a way? Were they there? Were they there in those frozen trenches? Had they been through what those soldiers had been through? Were they as scared as what those soldiers were? I very much doubt it. Now, we already heard early in the podcast that the British High Command were concerned about what the Germans were going to do over the Christmas period, and it probably didn't enter their heads at all that such an event would occur, like a ceasefire. One of the British generals in charge of this area of the battlefield in 1914 was General Smith Dorrien. He visited the trenches, or some of the trenches, during the truce, but the areas that he went to, they were not engaged in the fraternisation. When he got back to his headquarters, though, he heard about what had been going on, and he wrote a memorandum. And at the end of it, it said, "I would add that, on my return, I was shown a report from one section of how, on Christmas Day, a friendly gathering had taken place of Germans and British on neutral ground between the two lines, recounting that many officers had taken part in it. This is only illustrative of the apathetic state we are gradually sinking into, apart from also illustrating that any orders I issue on the subject are useless, for I have issued the strictest orders that on no account is intercourse to be allowed between the opposing troops. To finish the war quickly, we must keep up the fighting spirit and do all we can to discourage friendly intercourse. I'm calling for particulars as to the names and officers and units who took part in this Christmas gathering with a view to disciplinary action." Sounds a bit harsh, but when you think about it, you can see where he's coming from. His job is to beat the Germans. His job is to win the war. And how can he do that if not only other ranks, but his officers are getting to know the men that they're supposed to be killing? Now, it wasn't all football and presents and frivolity. We go back to Henry Williamson again, and he tells us that they discussed the First Battle of Ypres, which had finished, what, a month before this. He discussed what had happened with his German counterpart.
"I talked to an officer the next day, because the truce went on for 7 days, and he said, 'You know, we could not have gone on in the First Battle of Ypres because you had so many reserves in your woods and so many automatische pistols.' I said, 'Well, all the machine guns gone, they're all knocked out.' And he said, 'Oh no, your automatische pistol. It was a 15 rounds rapid.' We also learned that many of the German mess tags were made by boys, German students of 16 and 17, arm in arm with one rifle among three."
So eventually, after a few days, many of the men that had been in the frontline trenches were relieved, as were their German counterparts, and the truce ended. And it never really happened again. So much happened in the next few years. There wasn't, I suppose, anyone that wanted to have a truce with their enemy. There was too many dead, too many mutilated, too many wounded. Now, there was George Ashurst. He was one of those that was there, and this is how he felt when he received the order saying that the truce must end.
"We got orders come down the trench. Get back in your trenches every man. By word of mouth, down each trench. Everybody back in your trenches, you know, and shouting. The generals behind must have seen it and got a bit suspicious. So what they did, they gave orders for a battery of guns behind us to fire and a machine gun to open out, you know, and officers to fire their revolvers at the Jerrys, you know. Of course, that started the war again. Oh, we were cursing them to hell, cursing the generals and that. You want to get up here in this stuff. I mind your big giving orders and your big shutters and driving about in your big cars. We hated the sight of bloody generals."
We've listened to George's words before. He was one of those Lancashire Fusiliers that was in the sunken road in the Somme, 1st of July 1916. And he got a lot to say, had George. I think it's about 18 hours of recordings that he made with the Imperial War Museum. He's quite a character, as you could tell from that piece of audio. So, looking back to that Christmas, which is now 109 years ago, it seems incredible, doesn't it, that it took place amongst the slaughter, the beginning of the slaughter, which was to go on for four long years. There is evidence that there were small truces in the subsequent years, but nothing like what happened in that first Christmas. But I think when I look back at what we've just been talking about, to me, it shows the human side of the war, the fact that these highly trained professional soldiers at this stage were killers. They were trained to kill. As that German said, this wasn't sport. This was a fight to the death. So many of those men, what was the original professional, contemptible army that they were accused of being, became casualties over the next few months. Not many of them got through the entire war. I wonder what happened to those German counterparts that they met and became friends with for just a short time. Be fascinating, wouldn't it, to be able to go back in time, bring those men back to life in old age and get them to meet up and discuss what happened to them and perhaps have another glass of schnapps. But that's all in my mind. These are just thoughts that come to me as I sit here a few days before Christmas. As darkness falls, I can see Christmas decorations around me in the streets around me. And I think back to those Christmas trees that the Germans put up and songs that they sang, even singing the British National Anthem. And I think perhaps the final word should go to the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle. Just 2 years later, with the war still going on, Doyle wrote, "One human episode among the atrocities which have stained the memory of the war." So where can you go now if you want to remember the Christmas truce? Well, if you're in the UK, you can go to the National Arboretum in Staffordshire and you'll find a bronze sculpture depicting a handshake between a British soldier and a German soldier. And the sculpture is encased with an open mesh steel football. The British soldier is supposed to be from the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. There's an inscription carved into the stone in the front of the plinth. And it says, "Christmas Truce, 1914, Football Remembers. This memorial was dedicated by His Royal Highness the Duke of Cambridge, President of the Football Association, on the 12th of December, 2014. If you ever get the chance to go over to the Western Front, go to Messines, the town that's famous for the successful 1917 battle, but was also the location, one of the locations of the Christmas Truce of 1914. And in the main square, just outside of the Tourist Information Office, you'll find a memorial that was sculpted by a man called Andrew Edwards. And it shows a British soldier, a German officer, shaking hands, and in between them is a football. And the detail of this memorial is quite fantastic. You can see the equipment that both sides were wearing at this stage in the war. The German soldier with his Pickleborough helmet and the British soldier with his cloth cap. It really does give you an idea of what those men were going through at that stage, that early stage of the Great War. So once again, thank you very much for tuning in to Tales from the Battlefields. And next week, we're going to be doing something different because we're going to be talking about the Salonika campaign out in Greece. We've got the relative of one of the soldiers that was wounded in one of the battles out there, and he comes on to explain to us not just what happened to his relative, but give us some understanding of the Salonika campaign itself. And it's another one of those stories that until I talked to him, I had no knowledge about whatsoever. So it's a fascinating lesson if you've got time to do that next week. But for now, I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we'll end by playing The Last Post, in memory of all of those British and German soldiers that took part in the Christmas truce 109 years ago.